Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Hughes, and he'll be answering your most important questions on wet flies. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we will try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Hughes about wet flies. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk weight and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. They're located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or you can call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dave's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Dave's latest book, Wet Flies, and that's courtesy of Stackpole Books. So here's how you can win Dave's book, Wet Flies. You have to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something that Dave and I have talked about during the show. You know, must submit the answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage, the same place you can ask questions during the show. And so listen closely and use your best typing skills, and the first person that puts in the correct answer wins Dave's book. Our guest tonight is Dave Hughes. Dave is editor of the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal and author of more than 20 books about fly fishing for trout. They include the classic Western Hatches with Rick Heafley, American Fly Tying Manual, Handbook of Hatches, Reading the Water, Tactics for Trout, Strategies for Still Water, Dry Fly Fishing, Nymph Fishing, Fly Fishing Basics, Wet Flies, The Massive Trout Flies, Essential Trout Flies, Taking Trout, Trout from Small Streams, Western Fly, Mayfly Hatches, and Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters. Dave was a founding president of Oregon Trout in 1983 and was awarded life membership in the Federation of Fly Fishers in 1985. He's a life member of the Fly Fishers Club of Oregon and his home club, the Rainland Flycasters in Astoria, Oregon. Dave is an accomplished amateur aquatic entomologist. His hobbies include collecting, identifying, and photographing aquatic insects that are fed upon by trout, as well as tying and fishing the flies that match those insects. Well, Dave, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. That sounds like a guy that spent a lot of time writing and a lot of time fishing.
Yeah, a lot of time writing, that's for sure. That's a lifetime of work, I know, and something to be very proud of.
It definitely is.
Yeah,
I am.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we have a ton of questions that came in. After I compiled them, I was just telling Dave, probably another 10, 15 more questions came in after I put them all together for Dave to organize. So as an audience, you folks have really come through, and it's going to be hard for us to get through everything tonight, but we'll do our best. And we were talking before the show, and I said, Dave, I didn't know Wet Flies were so popular. And he said it might be his fault for writing books like Wet Flies. So why don't you explain, maybe that's where we start here, Dave, is, you know, what is it with Wet Flies and, you know, why the resurgence?
Well, I think the resurgence is, well, in part because of my book, so it's my fault, as we talked about earlier. But, you know, I think a lot of people are realizing now that wet flies work. They catch a lot of fish, and not only do they catch a lot of fish, but sometimes they can be pretty simple to fish. So you can get into a situation that you can't solve, a hatch or something like that, and switch to wet flies and catch fish. And if you've got somebody that's just getting into fishing, you can put one or two wet flies on the end of their line and let them swing it through a riffle, and they'll catch fish. So I think the main reason for their resurgence is that they're very effective. The main reasons for their going out of popularity was that at the same time that people realized that the bright, gaudy wet flies that we used at first in this country in the 1800s stopped working when the brown trout and et cetera came in. And then the dry fly took over, and then the nymph took over, and they sort of subsumed the wet fly. But there's been a real resurgence in the knowledge that the old wet flies, if you make them look like the aquatic insects in some way, or make them more drab, tone them down, whatever, they work. So they catch a lot of fish. They're a lot of fun to fish. So that's pretty good reasons. They're effective. They're fun.
Mm-hmm. What is the history about it? Are these flies that go back to early days in England and something that was brought over from there?
Well, I think you could say that the earliest flies were wet flies because they didn't have any means of making flies float. So you go back into the history of the fly fishing, and it's the history of wet fly fishing. Certainly there was no nymph fishing until, we're going to say, the 1930s. Ray Bergman wrote his book Trout in 1938 and had early nymphs in it. So that's when nymphing started, dry fly fishing started, and maybe almost 100 years before that, 80 years before that, in the late 1800s. Up until then, it was wet fly fishing. From Dame Juliana Berner's book in 1496, if you look at her fly patterns, there's no pictures of them. You've got to imagine it. Mm. But they were wet flies, and also it's interesting to note that they were wet flies that were tied to not necessarily imitate, but to approximate the hatches that she was dealing with. Mm-hmm. So the history of fly fishing is the history of wet flies.
Okay. Chris in Rogers, Arkansas, wrote in, he says, do you believe wet flies are effective because they mimic a specific insect catch, or is it because their action inspires strikes in the same way streamers do?
Well, I think it can cut both ways. Certainly if you're in a hatch, and the trout are taking subsurface, it's a caddis pupa or an emerging mayfly, and you tie on a wet fly that looks like that and fish it in the way that that insect is rising toward the surface, then you're imitating that insect with a wet fly. And the flip side of that is if you're out there in a riffle fishing wet flies and a trout looks up and says, wow, there's something going overhead that looks alive and good to eat, I'm going to go up and whack it, well, then you're inciting that same kind of strike that comes to a streamer. So it cuts both ways. They can work in either situation.
Well, let's talk about flies for a few minutes here. On the cover of your book, and folks, you're going to want to get this book. And by the way, I just checked on Amazon, and if you have a Prime account like I do, you can have it by the 18th. So you can be fishing wet flies by this Saturday. So
what's in time for
plug.
Christmas? You can give it to your friends for a present.
You can give it to yourself for a present, Dave.
Well, I think everybody should do both.
There you go. Yeah. Give your buddy one and give yourself one. There you go. Well, on the cover, you say, you know, tying and fishing soft tackles, flimps, and winged wets, and all for wet flies. Can you kind of describe the difference between those four and maybe the application of each, you know, briefly?
Well, yeah, the difference is the soft tackle, the most important part of the fly, obviously, is the hackle. In the flimp, the most important part of the fly is that rough body that entrains a bubble of air and looks alive underneath the water. In the winged wet flies, you can imagine the wing would be the most important part of the fly. And in the All for a Nymph, well, it's all fur, so the whole thing is important. I mean, they're all important. All of the parts of each one are important, but the distinction is in which part is most important. And in the soft hackle, it's the hackle. The flimp, it's the fur body. And the wing, the winged wet, it's the wing. And in the All for Wet, it's the, probably the fur hackle collar and the body. So those are the, that's how you distinguish them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they all have rather large hackles. And is, would you say one style is more likely to resemble a natural than others? And others, like maybe the All Fur Wet, more of an attractor?
Well, kind of the opposite. The All Fur Wet might be tied to imitative pupa, or so it would be more likely to be an imitative fly in the way that I would use it. And a flimp would be more of an imitation, an insect emerging or something. The term flimp means not yet a fly, but not no longer a nymph. So it imitates that stage between the fly and the nymph. So Pete Heide coined the term flimp. So it's an emerger, and that would imitate a natural insect. The winged wet, I'm looking on the cover at the hairs are wet, and that would really do a good job of imitating. There's a lot of groups of caddis that dive down to the bottom as adults to lay their eggs, and trout will take a surface fly when that's happening, but they're much more likely to take a wet fly. And the winged wet imitates the adult caddis female, of course, unfortunately, diving to the bottom to lay her eggs.
What do you mean, unfortunately?
Unfortunately for the female caddis, I guess is what I was saying. Unfortunately, it's only female caddis who do this.
they're going to get eaten, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I'm just apologizing to female caddis for the nature that makes them have to lay their eggs on the bottom and therefore get eaten by trout.
Yeah, get eaten on the way down, yeah.
That's right.
Okay, good. And we've got a whole slew of questions about flies particularly here, but Rod in Portland, your neck of the woods up there. He says, what are your top three materials to constructing wet flies? Are there three favorites you have?
Well, yeah, I guess I would say probably the material I use a lot is Hairzir Plus number 4, which is natural hairzir. It's a combination of natural hairs, mask, fur, and antron, so it's got some sparkle in it. So that's a Hairzir Plus. I use a lot of that. Brown hen hackle, I tend to use a lot of brown hen hackle. In fact, I'm going to have to go out on a search here and find some more. Mine are all getting picked over. And peacock hurl, a friend of mine calls peacock hurl trout cocaine, which may be a bad reference, but it's an indication that trout go crazy for peacock or anything with peacock in it. So those three materials, if I had to pick out three, would be the three I would pick.
Now, what
I'd sure
you
hate
said,
to be limited.
Yeah, when you said the Hairzir Plus, so you're taking natural Hairzir Plus what particular kind of antron color? Or?
Oh, you know, it could be clear or it could be the color of the Hairzir. I think it's usually clear, just to add some sparkle. Mm-hmm. I don't mix it myself. I just buy it mixed because it's easier. But
oh,
if I
okay.
do mix it, then I just snip up clear antron, put it in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then just dub it like you'd normally do it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Usually rough, though.
Yeah,
it's a rough dubbing.
And Camilo in Westford, Massachusetts asked, have you used the Tenkara-style wet flies, and what are your thoughts about those?
Well, I've used them a little bit. My wife's Japanese. I do a lot of Tenkara fishing. I took it up 20 years ago and have been kind of bemused by the fad that came to America about 6-7 years ago. But I really appreciate it also, and I've fished with Daniel Gagliardo of Tenkara USA, and he uses just the Kambari fly. But I fish out of my small stream box when I'm fishing Tenkara, and it's got a few Kambari flies in it, but it's got a lot of dry flies, a lot of nymphs, a lot of wet flies, of course, and a few streamers. So when I'm fishing Tenkara, I'm usually doing it out of my small stream fly box, and I would say that I use Kambari flies. Maybe 10% of my Tenkara fishing is with Tenkara flies. That's mm-hmm. putting it pretty succinctly. So.
Yeah, so you're just giving yourself more variety in the flies, but using the style of fishing.
The people who are interested in Tenkara There's a really good book on Tenkara out, and I would recommend they get that. But I also wrote a new edition of my Trout from Small Streams. It has a long chapter on Tenkara fishing in it. So that would be a source of information. And even has a picture of a trout with a kabari fly in its mouth.
Oh, there you go. So. Good, good. Eric in Bloomsdale, Missouri, wrote in and asked, what color pattern do you have the best luck with catching rainbow and brown while using a sparkle soft tackle?
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking for the Ozark fly fishing. I don't know how close Bloomsdale is to St. Louis, but maybe there's a chance to get together there.
Yeah.
I thought about that a little bit, and I typically when I'm using soft tackles and I'm using sparkle, it'll be crystal flash and it'll be orange or amber. But then I remembered that I was up on the Skagit River in southern British Columbia last year during a blue wing olive hatch, and I had a number 16 blue wing olive soft tackle with crystal flash. It was peacock crystal flash and blue dun hen, and I just really hammered the fish with that during a blue dun hatch when I couldn't do much with dries, couldn't get a good drift. So that became my favorite in a hurry. So my sparkle soft tackle is the number 16 blue wing olive crystal flash and blue dun hen. Very simple fly to tie.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of these are simple, aren't they? I mean, in general, the wet flies?
Most of the soft tackles are. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Some of the flumps get a little complicated, but, wet flies tend to be pretty simple in general.
Mm-hmm. Good place for maybe some people starting out tying to give it a shot.
Definitely the soft tackle.
Yeah. Barry in Wayne, New Jersey asks, Dave, what flash or triggers do you use in your wet flies?
Well, I use orange and olive crystal flash. I use Mylar tinsel. You know, those are old patterns, use tinsel. Well, that's flash. Oval tinsel, that's a flash. I use oval a lot, especially in flimps, because oval tinsel gives a bit of a weight to the fly to get it down through the surface film and sinking a bit, as well as being flash. I've been experimenting with glass beads and et cetera in recent years, so that would be another way to use flash. But typically when I use a glass bead, I kind of bury it in the fur and just I want that little wink of light coming out of it. But those are the things I use, the normal old tinsels and the crystal flash, and now I'm experimenting with beads.
Chuck Kaminsky in Choctaw, Oklahoma, asks, when tying and fishing soft tackles, how small do you go, 18, 20, 22?
Well, I would go 22 when I'm in trichos, and it's not that well known that when trout are feeding during a tricho hatch, sometimes they'll set up and feed just underneath the water, and they'll be so close to the surface that their tails break the surface. And if you don't look carefully, you'll say, wow, a trout's taking dries. But it's not. It's feeding subsurface. So during a trichos hatch, which I just fished on the Bighorn River in October, I'll go down to a size 22 soft tackle. And the Mother's Day caddis goes down to a 16 or 18. Starling and Hurl goes down to about a size 16. So 16 to 22, I'd say smallest is 22, more commonly 16 and 18. But I'll go down to imitate something that's small. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So did you hit a good trichos hatch on the Bighorn?
It was incredible. It went on for weeks. I was only there for 4 days, but it had gone on for weeks before I got there.
Yeah, it's amazing.
For a while after I left. Yeah, it was a very, very good hatch.
Oh, there's a lot of amazing hatches on the Bighorn. Black caddis, too, when you're covered with black caddis is incredible, too.
Well, it's interesting you say that because they say that the trico is coming up and the black caddis has receded in importance.
Oh, could be.
And I wasn't there long enough to know, but the people who are on the river all the time say that the tricos were important for 6 weeks. And the black caddis were not.
Yeah. Well, I'm remembering hatches from 25 years ago, too. So.
Well, yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, it's all like a big blur anymore. But, yeah, we just did a show on the Bighorn, and we talked quite a bit about the changes of, the river and how it's changing over the past 10, 15 years. And it is changing. It is changing for a lot of different reasons. But you got to listen to the show to find out.
There you go.
Okay, Jim Hampton, Cincinnati, Ohio. He says, what are your thoughts on Hewitt never sink fly pattern? he calls for Schlepen, but it's supposed to be fish as a skater. This means to me that it seems odd, as the feather isn't of the dry fly variety. Do you think that the flotation of the fly is provided by the tight line method he recommends? I don't know if that all makes sense to you.
A couple things come to mind there. The first thing is the Hewitt never sink fly pattern. Actually, Hewitt fished the never sink river. So I think that instead of thinking of this as a never sink fly pattern, we need to realize he just named it for the never sink river. And as to Schlepen, I've never heard that. That's the first reference I've come across to Schlepen in the in his skaters. Now, I use his skaters, and I think that he tied them originally with Badger Spade, and I think that he probably even grew his own or got somebody to grow special hackles for that. And I know right now, I think it's Hebert through Whiting that, and I could be wrong on that, but there are hackles being grown right now specifically for the Hewitt skater, and you can buy them, and they're big Badger. You know, they got the dark stripe and then the silver on the outside, and they make beautiful flies, and they're designed. It's very hard to get a feather that has long enough fibers and is the right colors for this particular pattern. So as far as I know, it's always been a dry fly Badger hackle on that fly. That's what I use, and I do use that fly quite a bit.
Okay. Well, maybe that'll help. Well, let's take a quick break here, Dave, and when we come back, we'll talk more about wet flies.
All right.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful magazines in the industry. Find out more about their premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Hughes about wet flies. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Dave, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, so I know finishing this book was probably a feat in and of itself. So what's happening?
Well, it's one of the first times in my life I don't have a next book planned right now, so that's good and bad. Mostly right now it's kind of relief and good. Interestingly enough, the Montana State University Special Collections Librarian was here in Portland visiting my studio. He was interviewing me and a bunch of other people, Rick Hafley and Tom Alkiron, Jim Schulmeier, John Judy, for the history project that he's working on. But they're also interested in collecting my papers. And it makes me realize that I've reached an age where I am, collectible, but also it's kind of paralyzing, so to speak, to think that what I've been doing is I've been gathering up my papers and trying to get them organized and get them labeled and et cetera, et cetera. It's been quite hectic. It's also been kind of educational and fun. And in truth, I'll probably be glad to have them out of my studio. But that's what I've been doing lately is gathering my papers on account of old age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another thing that I've been kind of doing that's cogent to what we're doing tonight is I've been working on minimalizing. And what I did is I have a huge wet fly box. In fact, I've got three or four of them. But I went out and bought at a fly shop, and I recommend you do this too, that everybody do this, little 995 flip-sided fly box that I can hold in the palm of my hand. And it holds probably about four dozen, maybe six dozen flies. And I fill that with the wet flies that I use most often. And that's what I fished out of most of this season. When I was wet fly fishing, that was my wet fly box. And it was kind of educational that I didn't feel like I was not covering any bases necessarily. So I guess that's one thing to say, that when you look at a book like Wet Flies, there's a lot of fly patterns in it. But really your job in reading it, if you have a job in reading it besides having fun, is to figure out which of those which few even of those flies are the right ones in your own fishing. Don't want to tie them all. Don't want to try to fish them all. You want to pick out the ones that work for you. And so I'm just fishing out of that small box. That to me, that's interesting because I'm trying to minimalist my life, and it's been fun. Another thing I'd like to mention is that just in my speaking schedule, because this just materialized, I'll be speaking to the Rainland Flycasters on 21 January. That's in Astoria, Oregon. I'll be at the Somerset, New Jersey Fly Fishing Show speaking on the 29th and 30th of January, and Linwood, Washington Fly Fishing Show on the 13th and 14th of February, and at the Ozark Fly Fishers on 20 February, and the Ellensburg, Washington Federation of Fly Fishers Regional Conclave, 29th and 30th of April. So if you're in any of those regions, there'd be a chance to get together and talk about wet flies.
Sounds good, yeah.
I hope that's all that's going on right now. What I'm trying to do right now is trying to get to the bottom of things so I can have a clear desk and a little bit of time to take my wife out to lunch or something.
There you go. Well, I wanted to ask you because a question came up tonight. Jim Hampton in Cincinnati, Ohio, asked about your book, Wet Flies, because this is the second edition. And he said he just returned the first edition to the library and purchased the second edition, so there you go. But he says, what's the differences between the two? What updates have you made?
I got to find myself in my notes here. Is that question?
That was the last, like second to the last I jumped to, just because.
I'm sorry. Okay, well, I made notes here, and I'm trying to follow them. But, I'll go without the notes. The big difference is there's 100 more pages. And I did a lot of editing. There's 100 more pages. It's all in color instead of black and white with color plates. And I added several chapters, one on Davy Watton. I went down and spent a day fishing with Davy Watton, picked his brain, did an article for Fly Rod and Reel, did a chapter on his methods called A Keeper of the Flame. Davy's just really, really a great one for traditional wet fly fishing methods. So, and got that in there and added a lot of new chapters. One is called Czech Wetting, where I worked out a method of fishing kind of the Czech style with wet flies. That's a lot of fun. And then I did a chapter on experimenting and with wet flies, and that's where I talked about beads and glass beads and flash and stuff like that. So there's a lot of additions to the book. I've had a lot of experiences in the last 20 years, and those got woven into the web of the book. So a lot of things.
Well, you had like 340 pages, so adding 100 pages was pretty significant.
Well, yeah, it's a third, more than a third new book,
larger,
I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And even the old part of the book is new book. I did a lot of work on the old part, too.
Oh, good, good. Well, there you go. And we actually did a show with Davey. It's been probably a couple of years, but if people want to look more into wet and look at what Davey's done, check out in our archive on wet flies there. In fact, you could just type in wet flies in the archive search box and find the shows that we've done. So, yeah, he's kind of an old master of wet flies.
Well, he's a master. He's not as old as I am, but he's really a master. He's the most knowledgeable person, and I say that in my book. He's the most knowledgeable person I've ever fly fished with.
Wow.
So
yeah.
He knows a lot, and it's not just about fly fishing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, continue on with talking about flies. Kevin in Plainfield, Illinois, he says, I own many of your books, and soft hackles are my go-to flies. My question to you is, what do you think of tungsten bead soft hackles? I tie soft hackles in front of the bead so that the bead supports the hackle. Thank you for all your fine books.
Well, I've started kind of going in that direction of experimenting with beads, too, and tungsten is on my list. But I just want to quote a line from my book here, if I can find it. It was in the introduction, actually in the foreword, and I was talking about changes. And this line that said, experiments have been made in the direction of incorporating beads, dash, glass, brass, and horrors, even tungsten, into wet flies. And I meant that tongue-in-cheek because I think it's a good experiment. And I define wet flies in this book as being unweighted and to be fished just subsurface. So I'm kind of violating my own definitions when I use tungsten. However, I think that that's kind of the next wave. That's where the exploration goes. That's where the experimenting goes. And it was in that chapter, and the experiments include tungsten. So I wouldn't say I've made a lot in that direction, but they're a direction to make experiments in. And I think that Kevin needs to do those experiments and write about them for all of us. So putting tungsten on a wet fly is a step away from tradition. But, you know, traditions are made to be broken. And today's experiments on old traditions become tomorrow's traditions. So they need to be made.
There you go. Now, you just said, and so I want you to expand on this, that, you know, adding tungsten maybe gets the fly down below the normal area that you fish. So what do you consider the normal area that you're fishing a wet fly in? In other words, you know, depth.
Yeah, probably the top foot or two of the surface. In the surface or just beneath it is the way I describe it. Actually, it was interesting that I'm going to read it here because it's only a line. In all the books when I went back to do my research this time, I didn't really pick it up last time, but nobody ever defined a wet fly except in terms of what it was not. The typical definition said, well, it's not a dry fly, it's not a streamer, and it's not a nymph. So I thought, well, that doesn't really define it very well. So I made an attempt to define it, and it's just my attempt, and it doesn't have to be anybody else's, but I defined a wet fly as an artificial fly tied on a short, standard length 1X or 2X long hook that is unweighted, hackled, and designed to be fished just subsurface or in the upper layers of the water column. End of definition. So I think you can see that adding tungsten, then you might be crossing that border into making it a nymph. It's still clearly a wet fly, but might be fished as a nymph. It might not be, but that's the definition I stuck with in this book, except in the chapter on experiments.
Okay.
In fact, that definition was in the chapter on experiments.
Okay. There you go. Good. That helps out. Jim Johnson in West Springfield, Massachusetts, asked, when tying a partridge feather on a soft hackle nymph, is it better to tie the quill and wrap the hackle from the tip, or tie the tip first and grip the quill to palmer the hackle?
You know, you can make a beautiful soft tackle either way. I've seen online, I've seen some people doing it, tying in the tip first and then wrapping the quill, wrapping it that way. And I feel like when I tie in the quill first, then I'm securing that, and I'm also tying in the fattest part. And then as I wrap it, I'm going to a thinner part that I can then tie down with less bulk. What I'm going to say about either method, and they're both equally good, is to end tying your hackle with your thread behind it, and then take two or three turns of your thread through the hackle after you've wound it back to the head, and then you will have locked in that hackle so that no matter which way you tied it in first, no trout is ever going to be able to chew it loose out of there. If you don't do that, you'll be subjected to having your hackle broken.
Okay,
so,
good tip, yeah. We did get a question here on the Internet, Fred in Little Neck, New York. He says, how do you feel about hook style, down eye versus up eye versus straight eye?
Well, that's an interesting question. Pete Heide, when he took me and Rick Hafley to his house and gave us a flimp tying kit and showed us how to tie his flimps, he used up eye hooks, and they were gorgeous things. And I think that Pete's reason for doing that was aesthetics. The flies were just prettier tied on up-eye hooks. Huh. I tie mostly on down-eye hooks. They're more available. I don't do it for any particular reason. Once in a while, I'll tie on an up-eye hook. But I'm going to stick with down-eye hooks. I don't think it makes any difference. But I'm just going to stick with them because they're what's available. They're traditional. I've got a bunch of them. I don't want to replace them. I've still got those hooks that Pete gave me. He gave me a range of partridge hooks, wet fly hooks with offset shanks and up eyes, and they tie a gorgeous fly, but not as available. So I'm going to just stick with down eye, and let's just say that the reason is availability.
Okay, okay. Another question here, because you kind of answered part of this about how small you go, but Jim in Boulder wrote in here on the Internet. He says, Dave, fly sizes vary by season and location. What have you found to be the most effective wet fly hook sizes, and have you found that you can or can't use slightly larger wet flies than nymphet patterns?
Well, I'm going to answer that by saying that I do a lot of my wet fly fishing looking at the insects. So if I'm looking at a size 14 insect, I'll be using a size 14 fly. And if it's a bigger insect, I'll use a bigger one. If it's smaller, I'll use a smaller one. If I'm doing what I call searching wet fly fishing, I'm going to say that my flies will run 12 and 14 and maybe 16. And that's my typical range of sizes, 12, 14, and 16. It would be the same for dry flies. For nymphs, I think one thing we overlook, and I've written about this, Rick Hafley has written about it, we've talked about it a lot, your average trout down there on the bottom of the stream makes its living eating size 16 insects and smaller, because that's the most abundant stuff. So we kind of get this impression that we need to go bigger so that they can see it. And the truth is they can see really small stuff. And one thing I always say, and I say this more in terms of nymph fishing than wet fly fishing, but if you're going to fish two flies, make sure one of them is size 16 or smaller. And I'm going to say the same thing in wet fly fishing. If you're fishing two flies, use what you want to use as the upper fly, but make sure that point fly is real tiny and give those trout a crack at something small. And I think what you'll find over time is that you catch more fish on the small fly than you do on the bigger one.
Interesting. Yeah. Another question on the Internet here that goes with tying is, how do you specifically tie in crystal flash on your soft tackles?
Well, I tie it in. I usually tie a little bundle of it and then twist it, and then I'll put the twisted crystal flash into a hackle pliers, and then you have to keep retwisting it as you go. And you'd like to think the result would be a segmented body, but it's actually usually flattens out. But it does give you a little bit thicker body that way. So that's what I tend to do, and tends to give a little more weight, and just gives me the appearance that I want. So I'm usually, when I'm using crystal flash, I'm tying it in over the length of the shank, back to the tail, and then I'm twisting it and wrapping it forward.
Okay. Question from Martin Coleman in Kansas. It says, what are the top three characteristics you look for in a wet fly pattern to entice fish?
You know, Lawrence, Kansas, my family's roots are in Lawrence, Kansas, and I was stationed at Fort Riley, and I did go to Lawrence, Kansas, and just recently I flew over Lawrence, Kansas and looked down at it rather wistfully. So there's my roots, but I haven't spent much time there, Martin.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, first is alive, what I'll call internal movement. In other words, the materials of the fly itself look alive, the soft tackle opening and closing, the body of the flimp capturing air and moving, and all for a wet moving, of course, and the wet fly hackle and everything moving. So the movement of the materials is the first thing. The second thing would be a lifelike form, you know, a shape that looks like a natural insect, especially when it's wet, instead of something plastic that doesn't look like anything in real life. And the third, I guess, would be realistic colors. And what I mean by that is not the gaudy colors of the old-fashioned wet flies in the old days, but more subdued colors that would look more like the natural insect colors in the modern day. So that's what I mean by realistic colors. I don't mean exact capturing of the color of a natural, because the naturals vary so much in color.
Mm-hmm.
So those three things.
Okay. Tom Sipe in Greensburg, Pennsylvania says, what would be a must-have pattern when fishing new water? So I'm guessing, you know, maybe he's asking about a searching pattern. Do you have a searching pattern?
Well, I'm just going to call it the Marchbound Spider. And that's a soft tackle. It's a Sil Nemus pattern out of his book, The Soft Tackle Fly, which, by the way, is an incredibly good book. And this Marchbound Spider just looks like a lot of things in nature that trout eat. So it covers a lot of bases. So it's a good searching fly, and it also can be a good imitating fly in a lot of situations.
Okay. Now, there were several questions regarding, you know, what's your favorite fly, what's your top flies, but I thought this one written by Barry was pretty good. Barry Gray's Lake, Illinois. He says, Mr. Hughes, I thought of a different Mr. Hughes, but your plane is going down. You know, he says, like any good fly fisher person, you grab your fly rod, reel, and one small fly box with only four flies in the box. What are those four flies? So that's an interesting, a fun way to ask the question.
Well, it is. I was in a helicopter that did just that. We got down safely, but I didn't grab any flies or rod or anything else. I grabbed my butt. the question
was that
the question,
fly fishing or was that military?
That was a little military. We weren't fly
yeah.
fishing. No. I guess I'm going to say that little olive harrowing dun would be a dry fly, and I'm not going to answer your question by saying four wet flies, because if I had four flies and my plane was going down, I'd want one dry and one wet and one nymph and one streamer.
Okay.
So I would take the olive harrowing dun in about a size 12, and the reason I say that, when I wrote an article about it once, is you can cut a lot of parts off that fly and make it look like a lot of different things. So that would be my one dry fly. I'd have the March Brown Spider be my wet fly. The Pheasant Tail Nymph would be my nymph. And the Muddler Daddy would be my kind of straddling streamer and wet fly. I don't know what you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But those four, so if my helicopter goes down again, that's what I want. But I don't want it to be on the Mekong River.
Right. No, definitely not. There were several other questions relating more to, you know, what are your favorite wet flies. So could you give us, you know, three to five favorite wet fly patterns? What did you put in your box this summer?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Let's see. Well, here we have Martin Coleman's question. If you can only fish five wet fly patterns, can we go to that? Is that?
Sure. Yeah.
What is my favorite wet fly? I have one favorite wet fly, and that was a question from Amy Glidden in St. George,
yeah.
Utah. I like the alder, and the alder has a whole bunch of things going for it. The first one is tradition. It was made and it, you know, came up with in 1857 to imitate the alder on the Itchen River. Well, I've got tons of alder flies on my local streams and ponds. So I have a lot of good luck with that particular pattern. So I get into a lot of situations that it solves, and I get a lot of good results with it. And I've just had a lot of fun with it over the years. So I'm going to call it the alder as my favorite wet fly. I never had thought of that question and really don't like to be stuck with that.
No. But these are always questions that come up for our guests. What's your favorite? And yeah, so...
My new favorite might be that number 16 blue wing olive soft tackle with the crystal flash body, just because I most recently had good luck with it.
Yeah.
If I could only fish five wet fly patterns, I'm going to go with a Muddler Daddy, what I call the anchor wet, which is in the book, March Brown Spider, Hairzer Wet, Lead Wing Coachman, and then I want to add a six, which is my number 16 blue wing olive soft tackle.
Okay, can you run through those again?
Muddler Daddy.
Yeah.
Anchor Wet. March Brown Spider, soft tackle. Hare's Ear Wet, which is a traditional winged wet. Lead Wing Coachman, traditional winged wet. And the number 16 Blue Wing Olive soft tackle.
Okay.
With the crystal flash body.
So there you go, Steve, in Charlotte, North Carolina. That'll get you. You got a bonus one there. Only asking for five. So. And Martin, I'm sorry, Martin. Steve was asking about, asking about warm water fly fishing and what's your favorites there, like for carp and so forth. Any change up in what you would select there?
Well, I do have a favorite for warm water, and that's a little olive soft tackle with a chenille body about a size 12, maybe even a size 10. It's just got an olive chenille body and pheasant rump hackle, one or two turns. And I've caught a lot of bluegills and et cetera on that. Carp I haven't fished much for, and I don't have an answer for carp. So
yeah. They can be tough critters.
Well, they're too tough for me. I've got a situation where I can see them, but I can't catch them.
Yeah. No, I've been there. Definitely a challenging fish. Okay, let's talk. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll talk about terminal tackle and rigging and so forth for wet flies. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you can sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Dave Hughes about wet flies. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can tonight on the show. Okay, Dave, we've got a lot of questions about terminal tackle and rigging and so forth. Martin Coleman, again, asked about your favorite rigging technique for fishing wet flies.
You know, my favorite rig for fishing a wet fly is just to nip off a dry fly and tie on a wet fly to what I'm already fishing. So that would be just the simplest I can do, and very effective, and most of the time works very well. So I'm going to say that I just tie one wet fly direct to the tippet. Gives me the fewest tangles, the most control over my presentation. So that would be the way that I would fish them more often than not.
A one fly rig, right? And that goes to maybe our next question here. Freda in Denver says, since the take is more aggressive on wet flies, what's the smallest tippet you use? Can or should I use 6X when conditions require? Or is fishing wet flies more like a streamer setup in terms of leader and tippet?
Well, I really rarely find it necessary to go below 5X. I'd use 6X if I was fishing a trico or if I was fishing something real small, if I was fishing in a real delicate situation. I think we come to that old conundrum that the tippet that's fine enough to fool them isn't heavy enough to catch them, hold them and not break. But one thing that might help in this regard is the way that the hook is set. And very, very often when you're fishing wet flies, especially on the swing, you'll feel a tug, a little increase in wet and weight out there. Try to refrain from setting the hook just exactly as you would in summer steelheading if you've ever done that. You let the fish set the hook itself. Don't respond until the weight of the fish is on there. And then you lift your rod and not necessarily set the hook, but just engage the fish. And that's very important if you're using 6X, that you don't hammer the hook home. Because if you do that with 6X, you'll break them off pretty regularly. So keep in mind the idea when you're wet fly fishing of letting the fish hook itself, and you can go down one or two sizes and tip it and still have the success you'd like to have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Rick in Huntersville, North Carolina, says, Dave, I assume you fish your wet flies at various depths. What are your methods of presenting the flies at various depths? What determines the depths you want to fish the flies?
Well, again, Rick, that kind of gets back to my definition of that the wet fly, by definition, is made to be fished in the top foot or two of the water column. So I don't fish them at a lot of depths deeper than that. If I do, I kind of think of myself as being nymph fishing when I do, so I don't necessarily think that I'm wet fly fishing. But a couple of things here that I find myself fishing clear intermediates more and more. I fish them tremendously on lakes a lot. I think they make a huge difference. And I find myself fishing with what's more. So I guess you could say that I am going to deeper depths and that I've exceeded the limits of my definition and that I may have to write an apology at some point. But at any rate, if I were what determines the depths you want to fish the flies, that would be where the fish hold. Where are the fish holding and feeding? That would be the depth I'd want to get to. So I fished a little bit in North Carolina, some situations where the fish are pretty deep, and you need to get down there. The streams I was fishing were too small to fish anyway, but straight upstream. So the only way to get flies down, you couldn't fish by moving off to the side and getting a swing. So the water was just too small. So it'd just be a way of whatever the fish are holding at, that would be the depth I'd want to fish. And if that meant I wouldn't have to go down with nymphs, well, then I would forego wet fly fishing and go down after them with nymphs, mostly because I like to catch fish.
Well, and so does that kind of say, you know, with your definition of a wet fly and the way to fish it and that top foot and a half column, it basically, you know, in most water that's more than a few feet deep, do we have to have a hatch going on? Are we primarily fishing for emergers and, you know, insects just below the surface?
Well, you're right in that way, in that wet fly fishing does cause you to look at shallower water, look for riffles, look for runs that are shallower, look for tail outs, et cetera, the currents that enter the pool, rather than fishing the depths of a pool. In fact, when I'm thinking of North Carolina right now, I'm thinking of a certain pool where the fish were 4 or 5 feet down, holding right where the current dropped out into a spot. And you really had to get a nymph to get down to them because we could only fish upstream. So, yes, I would say that. And I would say that I'm experimenting toward violating my own definition and looking at those deeper depths. So, and that's what we all should do is violate our own definitions. I recommend
freedom. And I get the picture that, you know, you aren't strictly a wet fly fisherman.
You
do what it takes.
I've written books on other subjects.
Yeah.
It does turn out that the publisher of Stackpole Books, who passed away recently, said that it really shows that I love wet flies in the book, you know, because when you have a passion for something, it shows in the book you write about it. So certainly probably my favorite thing to do is wet fly fishing. But
go ahead. I'm sorry.
If fish want to be caught another way, I'm willing to accommodate them.
There you go. Yeah. Well, we do have some other questions about that because I think, you know, I think it was good that we talked about, you know, your definition and so forth because, like Brian in Clifton Park, New York, he says, sinking fly versus sinking line. When you want to get down to the fish, what's your preference? And then another question, Boris in Ohio, how often do you use intermediate sink line when fishing wet flies? In what situations? There was another question on weighting or unweighting flies. So, you know, let's talk about, do you weight any flies, or is it all the natural weight of the fly with no extra weight because you're only in that foot and a half column?
Well, it isn't do I weight any fly. I mean, I fish nymphs, and they're weighted.
No, I mean for wet flies.
The question might be reversed and say when you weight a fly, is it a wet fly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yes, you know, if you want to put a tungsten bead in there instead of a glass bead, that's still a wet fly. It looks like a wet fly. You know, the person who I think captured this best, and I'm going to recommend somebody else's book right now, is Alan McGee's book, Tying and Fishing Soft-Tackled Nymphs. And just by saying soft-tackled nymphs,
there you
he redefined the whole subject. And he said, it's okay to do this because now you're talking about a nymph, even though it's a soft tackle. So this is a brilliant book, and it's the one that takes things a step forward. And if you've read my wet fly book, you need to go buy Alan's. If you haven't read my wet fly book, you need to buy mine first and then go buy Alan's. But at any rate, I heavily recommend Alan McGee's book because it answers these questions. You know, I restricted myself by my own definition and wrote a chapter on experiments with wets, and I quoted Alan heavily in that chapter. But listen, all these experiments go back to Alan's book, and I think that they should be made, and I think people should read his book. It's a very good book, and it's got new methods in it that weren't in my book, and I'm talking about fishing methods. But it gives you permission to make all of these experiments that I haven't given you permission to make and still call it wet fly fishing. So read Alan's book is what I'm trying to say here, and I might be saying that in part to get myself off the hook.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, maybe that's.
And I do find myself fishing more and more with a clear intermediate line, and that's a sinking line.
Even on streams, or is that just with lakes?
Yeah, no. I do it a lot on lakes already. Now I find myself turning more to it on streams.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Dino in Michigan, he was asking about weighted flies too, but he had a second question, which is, how do you like to fish multiple flies, tied to hook or off short droppers? Is there a reason for one way or the other?
Well, when I fish nymphs, I tie them off the hook. When I fish wet flies, I tie them off a dropper to give them more movement. I'm not trying to get them down as deep. I've got them more separated. I want them to have the freedom of not having something behind them tugging them. Tradition is a lot of it. Traditionally, a wet fly is tied to the strong tag of a knot where you've tied the tippet on. So when I do that, I follow the tradition. And I do that a lot. I follow tradition. In my own definition of wet flies, a lot of why I define them that way is I'm following tradition. Another reason is that you have to have some limit when you write a book. If you don't have some limit when you write a book, then you start writing a book about wet flies and you wind up writing a book about nymphs, and then you got to write about nymph fishing, and you get away from your subject. So, at any rate, to get back to this, I think if I'm fishing weighted flies, I think I'm nymphing, and if I'm using multiple flies in wet fly fishing, I'll tie them on that tag off the hook knot, off the tippet knot. And I usually fish two. I don't usually fish three. And the reason, it might be my own klutziness or something, but I just get into a lot more tangles fishing three flies than I do fishing two.
Yeah.
So I most often fish with one. If I want to go to multiples, it's usually multiples of two. So.
Yeah, right, yeah. I had a question from Joe in New York. How can we fish wet flies in the deeper, faster runs? Weighted flies, sink tip leaders, a multi-fly rig with heavy nymphs, casting far upstream, and lots of mending. So he offered a bunch of possible solutions. What's your take on?
You know, I came up with what I called an anchor wet. It's a wet fly that I tie on a pretty big hook, and I tie it on the heaviest nymph hook I can find. And I don't add weight to it, but I use the heaviest nymph hook I can find. And if I'm trying to get deep, I'm going to, just because of my definition of wet fly fishing, I'm going to fish it upstream, and I'm probably going to fish it on a floating line on a long leader, and I'm going to use that really heavy hook to be my weight to get it down. And I do that a lot in small stream fishing to medium stream fishing where the water is maybe 2 to 3 feet deep and fairly brisk. Then it's a good situation for check nymphing. And I came up with what I call check wetting, where I use this anchor wet and use that as my point fly. And then 3, 4, 5 feet, depending on the depth of the water above that, then I dangle a muddler daddy on that dropper, on that tag. And then I cast, I give that anchor wet time to sink. And then I brace the other fly against it. I'm fishing upstream. I lift my rod, lift up that muddler daddy, and sometimes I dap it and dangle it. Most often I fish it just underneath the surface, but I fish it by leading it downstream. So in a way, I'm kind of check nymphing, but I'm check wetting, what I call it, because I've got that one wet fly down deep, and I've got the other one right up near the surface, usually where I can see it, although it's just submerged. It's some of the most beautiful takes to it when you do that. Just looks like the bottom, part of the bottom detaches itself, lifts up, intercepts that fly, and then just sinks back down. You lift the rod, set the hook, and you've got a fish on. So my way of getting deep to answer the question would be to cast upstream with a wet fly tied on a really heavy hook and a long leader.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a question on the Internet that Bill Thomas in Charlotte says, is there a special knot to tie the fly to the tippet for more movement? Or what knot do you use?
Well, that would be the perfection loop, and that would do it. I like to use the Davy knot, which is a really tiny wet fly knot, real tiny knot, And to be absolutely honest, my go-to knot is the old improved clinch knot, and that's what I use most of the time. If you want to give your fly freedom of movement, though, learn the perfection loop, which I do a lot in nymphing, and use that. So the answer would be some sort of loop, but I've gone away from the Duncan loop because it's not fixed, and every time you catch a fish, it slides down, you have to slide it back up. So when I use a loop knot, I want it to be a fixed loop, not a sliding loop.
Good. Another question about attaching the flies. Don in Belgrade, Montana, Don Bishop, and Don actually helped me start this program back in 2006, so a longtime friend of mine. He asks, what is the place for a riffle hitch with wet flies?
Well, I don't use one. I'm kind of guilty here that I don't use a riffle hitch in my fishing at all. It's an out-of-Atlantic salmon fishing and summer steelhead fishing, and I'm not up to the speed on using it. And I just haven't. And I have another note here. I need to be instructed here. I need Don to tell me. In fact, he's in Belgrade. He should invite me fishing.
Watch out, he will.
My brother owns Eva Knievel's place in Butte, Montana, so I spend a fair amount of time back there. Spent a month back there this year in Belgrade. In fact, Hazel Nemus, Sylvester's widow, lives out here in Portland. We see her a lot now, so Don probably either knew Sylvester or knew Hazel, and she's out here now.
Yeah, the riffle hitch, I had to look that one up, too. I said, what's Don talking about? And I went out on YouTube and found a couple of videos. But it's, you know, it's a way to tie, after you've tied the fly on, to do a couple of half hitches back over the front of the hook there behind the eye. And then it allows you to pull the fly from one side or the other side or from the bottom or the top by twisting that double half hitch assembly around the fly. So it makes the fly pull at an off angle rather than straight. So, I guess it can be used to get it. They were talking, and when I looked at it, it was talking about, you know, making the fly go at a particular angle through the stream that was not straight away. So I guess he was thinking there might be some use of that in a wet fly as well. So
I think he's sandbagging us, and he knows the answer, and he's going to have to write this article so that we can find out. I want him to write an article here so I can read it.
Oh, there you go. There you go, Don. If you're listening, you've been challenged. So, or maybe you just need to test it yourself there. So, and then let us know. So, okay, let's talk about some strategies and tactics here, since we're getting into some of those things now. Anyway, Brian in Clifton, New York. He's asking, is there a process you go through to determine what flies you're going to use, size, color, species, how long do you fish, and then also how long do you fish a spot before you move on or change flies?
Well, the process would be, if it's a searching situation, I would choose flies that have worked for me in my past, which I have a long past now. They're collecting my papers. I must have a long past. So I have a lot of experience, and I've got this little box of flies that I'm still holding in my hand here, and it's full of flies that have worked for me. And I would pick out of that box what has worked in a searching situation. If it's a situation where the trout are feeding on an insect, then the process I follow is to try to collect the insect and get a close look at it, and then pick out the fly from that little box that looks closest to it and fish that. So how long do I fish in one spot? Well, I'm restless. I move a lot. There's only a few people in life who fish at the same pace I do, and it's a pretty fast pace. So I move a lot, and I change flies pretty fast. So my answer there is Rick Hafley gives a slideshow, and he talks about the five deadly sins in fly fishing, and he talks about the deadliest sin is what he calls rootitis, and that's getting rooted to one spot and just fishing it. And we've all seen people do this, and for me it drives me crazy because I just want to keep galloping on, partly because I want to see what's upstream and partly because I want to get fresh water. So I'll only stay where I am doing what I'm doing if I'm catching fish. Otherwise, I'm moving and I'm changing. And I'm probably doing it pretty much more quickly than somebody else is, the average person
okay.
is.
Okay. Scott Nelson in your neck of the woods, too, Portland, Oregon, he says, what specific hatches do you think that are best fished with wet flies as opposed to nymphs and dry flies?
Well, hi, Scotty.
You know him?
Of course.
Oh, okay.
You don't know Scott? He's a good guy. I would say, you know, I mentioned a long time ago that one of my favorite wet flies is the alder. So if alder flies, and I'm fishing a still water or maybe a small stream, and the alder flies are dropping out of the trees, the thing about the alder is that it doesn't swim very well. It lands on the water and it sinks. So you see alders in the air and you think, wow, I got to fish a dry fly to imitate this. But you really need to fish that ancient wet fly. So the alder fly, if you see alder flies, go to the wet fly. If you see ovipositing caddis adults diving to the water, and this is very difficult to notice when they're doing this, you have to be pretty observant, but you'll see caddis in the air, and if you watch them, maybe even with binoculars, you'll see that some of them are splatting themselves into the water. And what they're doing is they're driving themselves through the surface film, and this happens a lot on the Deschutes River where Scott fishes, then they're swimming down to the bottom to lay their eggs, and that's that case where I said that, you know, I apologized to the females and said it was unfortunate, but it is the females going down to lay their eggs because males don't have eggs. And you want to imitate that with a wet fly, a winged wet fly. And a pupil caddis coming up to the surface, you know, you'll see splashy rises once in a while, and trout might be taking pupil caddis. And when they are, then you're much better off with a wet fly than you are with a dry. So whenever trout are persnickety about dry flies, then I'll switch to a wet. Especially if I see them working, but I can't catch them on a dry, I'll immediately kind of suspect either an emerger or a pupa or whatever's going on, and switch to a wet that imitates that as well as I can.
What is,
there you go, Scott.
Yeah. When you're looking at the fish feeding at or on the surface, what are the telltale signs that you should be looking for to try to determine whether they're, you know, feeding on dries or subsurface flies?
That's a really good question because typically when fish take something off the surface, they leave a bubble behind in their rise rings. And when they take something subsurface, even though their dorsal fin might break the surface or their tail and it looks just exactly like a rise, if there's no bubbles left in that, it's very, very often that they're not taking something off the surface. I sat on the Missouri River one time during a trico hatch. I was so frustrated I couldn't catch anything. And I tried and tried and tried, and I finally gave up, sat down, got out my little Nikon 7 power binoculars that I always carry, and just started watching the fish. And by golly, they weren't breaking the surface. They were taking just underneath the surface, and they were just, there were thousands and thousands of trico spinners on the surface, but there were just as many subsided and underneath the surface, and the fish were just going along with their mouths open just underneath the water, taking those that had, we used the word drowned, and that may be correct, but anyway, they were just under the water, and the fish were not taking on top, which is why I was frustrated.
So I learned that lesson. Yeah, I learned that lesson down in the San Juan one night. It was just turning dusk. The fish were seemingly rising all over the place, and I wasn't doing any good with dries. And I said, well, maybe they're not on the first surface. So I just tried a, emerger to my dry and then started fishing that way. I started getting into fish. And it was the
exactly.
same reason,
and sometimes when you do that, the key is getting underneath the surface, and you really don't have to be imitative.
You
can have the wrong fly and still catch fish as long as it's sunk in the zone that the fish are feeding in.
Yeah, because they're grabbing all kinds of stuff there, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, the Boris in Ohio says, do you have any rules of thumb based on the light angle, angle of light versus bright versus overcast, etc., when selecting wet flies?
No, you know, I'm not going to say that I do. That probably would get into the province of Davy Watton. We've got to get Davy Watton to write a book. Everybody get together here and get Davy would know this stuff. And I just
he would know that.
You know, let's all get together and get him to write a book.
Okay.
But my rules look more at what has worked in my past and what is hatching. So it gets back to kind of my rules of thumb are based on different things than the angle of light and bright versus overcast, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm not going to offer theories on those things, and I didn't in the book. So.
Okay, okay. Bob in Maryland said, Dave, hook me up. A gentleman was fishing wet flies beside me recently in a local spring creek, and it appeared as though he let his fly drift down in front of a fish and then proceeded to tease it in front of the fish. He hooked up on several of nice finicky spring creek trout. He says, I tried to follow suit, but I wasn't getting the same results. Is this presentation a matter of speed, position, or I assume both? I thought my presentation looked good, but I wasn't getting any solid reactions from the fish, just an occasional look. My last guess was that my fly was too large. Any help for Bob you can give?
Well, certainly if the fly was large, it was too large. If it was 12, size 12 or above, that would be a realistic assumption. And your friend may have been doing the Leisenring lift or an induced take or the Heidi subsurface swing. And these are all ways of making the fly come alive right in front of the fish. So your friend might have been sandbagging you by casting out, letting his fly swing into the side of the fish, and then just stopping his rod and making that fly lift and start to swim and look alive. So that would be my guess. And if your fly was above a size 16, unless there was some insect present that was bigger than that, I would say that going down to a size 16 fly would definitely be the first thing I'd do in a situation like that. And, of course, it might have been a matter of was his leader sinking and yours not, or whatever, which gets us into this conundrum of fluorocarbon versus non-fluorocarbon. And a lot of people are switching to fluorocarbon, and I haven't followed yet, and that's because it doesn't degrade. And I absolutely know that fluorocarbon is more effective, and in a situation like this might make a D difference, but I'm still not going to fish it in this situation. So I carry a little bit of fluorocarbon. I'll use it mostly on lakes, but it would be very, very, very rare that I would use fluorocarbon. But in a situation like this, fluorocarbon could be the difference in what he was doing and you weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
You might, Bob, go ask your friend if he was using fluorocarbon.
There you go. We skipped one, but I think it's an important one, so I'm going to jump back here, Dave. Top page, Rod from Portland. He says, Dave, thanks for sharing your experience and insights. I wonder how you breathe life into your wet fly on the swing. Do you look to swing it steadily through the drift, or do you twitch the fly to make it dance in the current? And they were just talking about that a little bit, so I want to
yeah,
get back.
Yeah, we were. And if this is the Rod I had dinner with the other day, hello, Rod. Well, I don't give a lot of action to my wet flies. I do that, what I just talked about in answer to Bob's questions, is that stopping the fly if I know it's in front of a fish and bringing it to life at that point. But my way of giving life to a fly is not to twitch it or to dance it. It would just be to slow it as absolutely much as possible as it swings and drifts on the current. Whatever I can do to slow it is the way that I try to give it more lifelike movement. So summer steelheading, same thing. Had a friend who was a guide on the Deschutes River for many years, and he said his philosophy was that the longer you could keep your fly out there in front of the fish, the more likely it was the fish was going to take it. And I think if whatever you can do to slow your wet flies in their swing within reason is the thing that makes them more lifelike. So I swing it steadily through the drift, more or less, with mends and stuff. I don't do much twitching and dancing.
Okay, okay. So I'm going to take that as an answer to Brian's question down further about animation, because basically we're talking about the same thing. John in Fort Worth, Texas, says, can you swing a soft tackle below a large weighted nymph? Well, there now it becomes by your definition, no longer a wet fly, right?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. It would work, but would you be wet fly fishing or nymphing? I mean, you've definitely got a nymph in front of the wet, so the nymph,
you're down.
The nymph's delivering the nymph now, the wet fly down there. So I think I'm going to call that nymphing, even though the fish took a wet fly. But good question, because it's effective. I mean, just because we're no longer wet fly fishing doesn't mean we're doing anything wrong. We're just not doing something that's in the purview of my book.
Right, exactly, exactly. And it might work just fine.
You know, I was down in Fort Worth and Dallas one time, and I came home. I used to edit Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, by the way. I no longer do.
Oh, you no longer? Okay.
Yeah, but I wrote an article on in the article, we went white bass fishing, and I said I liked it so much I moved to Texas. And I got so many phone calls. I realized that you really can't say such a thing with your tongue in your cheek. When you put it in print, nobody can see your tongue. So I love Fort Worth, Texas, and I love Dallas, but I didn't move there. But I'd like to get back and do more of that white bass fishing. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Brian in Clifton Park, New York. Again, asks, tractor flies, what are your thoughts on bright-colored flies and their placement in your cast of flies?
Well, the bright-colored flies I don't use much anymore. If I do use them, they would be what I'd call attractors, and Davy Watton would call attractors, and Ryan asked that in his question, attractor flies.
Yeah.
If I use them, they're going to be up high as the top dropper, and they would be my pusher fly, my top fly, the fly that I have up top to kind of attract the fish. And surprisingly enough, those, when you fish them that way, they catch a lot of fish. But that would be the way I would use attractor flies.
Which, you use a attractor like that to position your wet fly as a dropper off of that to get it in a particular part of the water column?
Yeah, well, it would be a little bit, what your attractor fly up top would be on a dropper, and your other fly would be on the point. But exactly what you
said, what I meant.
What you mean. And, yes, the answer would be yes. But, you know, when I look in this little box, I don't see any attractor flies. So there you go. You know, I don't use them that much. So in my big wet fly box, there are attractor flies, but they didn't get transferred to my little wet fly box.
Hmm.
So I must not use them.
So what was the decision process to get those flies into that box?
Well, flies that worked. Flies that, flies I caught fish on got into that little box.
I could do a
real quick inventory if there's time and interest.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, let me look at one side. One side is, I'm looking from right to left, mostly soft tackles, partridge in yellow, partridge in green, and, of course, that March Brown spider, partridge in orange. I see a long row of my little blue wing olive with the crystal flash bodies are winking in the light at me. And then Wimps, the March Brown spider, and one that I don't even know the name of, I picked up somewhere, and I caught a lot of fish on it, and I don't know what its name is, so I feel terrible. I know it's not one that I originated. It's a cute little fly that I can't describe. It's got a yellow body, a little bit of peacock on it, and a palmered hackle, and a tail. And it's tiny. It's about a size 16 or 18. And then the Tupps nymph, which the Tupps nymph is out of Leisenring and Heidi's book, The Art of Tying the Wet Fly. And I consider it a flimp and tie it as a flimp, but they called it the Tupps nymph. And that's one I catch a lot of flies on, a lot of fish on. And it's got a yellow body. And the reason I think it works so well is because you've got your yellow little yellow stones out there, your yellow sallies. And you've got a lot of mayflies, your pale evening duns, your pale morning duns that have this color. So that's one side of that box. Now I'm going to flip it over, open the other side, and the flies get a lot bigger. And here I have my winged wets, and I've got the hares here that I talked about. Of course, I've got the alder and the lead wing wet. And what I haven't mentioned that's really, really necessary is the light Cahill. And again, because it looks like yellow sallies and pale evening duns, pale morning duns, a lot of those things. So really important. And some all fur wets, usually an olive, and hare's ear. And hare's ear, I see some all fur wets with beads tucked in their middles here down in size 18. So I must have had blue wing olives in mind there. And then I have a row of big Muddler Daddies and Anchor Wets that kind of round out the box. And that's all that's in it. So it's not a lot of flies, but it covers a lot of bases.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you said you fished that this summer, are you talking about you just fished those as wet flies, or were those the only flies you were fishing this summer?
Well, those were the only wet flies. No.
Okay.
I didn't fish those as my only flies.
You didn't limit yourself that far.
No, I can't do that. In fact, this year, the water was so hot this year in Oregon that I had an experience where I was fishing where the water was 58 in the morning on my favorite stream. It was 68 at 11 o'clock or noon, and I'd quit fishing, and it'd be 78 in the evening. And actually left the river, and I took up smallmouth fishing, and I just did a lot of smallmouth bass fishing this year. And it was just respecting the trout in the high temperatures that we had this summer.
Yeah, so I hope
we don't have that again.
Yeah, you guys had some real water problems up there this summer.
Yep, we sure did.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, we've run out of time. I just happened to look up. I was having such a good time talking to you, Dave. I look up and
really?
I go, oh, my God, we're done. So,
I was having fun, too. I didn't know it was that late either.
Yeah, so we're out of time. But, hey, folks, including you, Dave, stick with me here a few more minutes. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And then, of course, we're going to be giving away a copy of Dave's latest book, Wet Flies, the second edition, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So you don't want to miss a chance at that. So stick with us here, and we'll give those things away, and then we'll call it a night. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes here, and the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is always a good organization to support, and if you don't have a membership or you don't win one tonight, go out and check them out at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and they support fly fishers all over the world in both warm water, cold water, and salt water, so good organization to be part of. So let me fire this up here, and sorry, folks, we didn't get to all the questions, but there were just so many tonight. I think the last time we got that many questions was with Brian Chan on Stillwater Fishing. So Dave, you're right neck and neck with Brian Chan here as far as generating questions.
The great Brian. I love Brian.
Yeah. Okay, so the winner for the Fed Fly Fisher, Fly Fishing, Federation of Fly Fishers is, come on here. John Oiter, I guess it is, O-E-R-T-E-R, John Oiter in Kentucky. So, John, congratulations. Let me just jot down your name here in Kentucky. And terrific. Well, congratulations, and I hope you'll enjoy that membership. I will be sending you an email after the show so that we can take care of the logistics of getting you hooked up there. Now our second prize we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at amatobooks.com, along with their other periodicals as well as their huge selection of fly fishing books. And that's Bill Wheeler in Washington. So Bill Wheeler, congratulations on that, and I know you'll enjoy that subscription. And now let's move on to give away Dave's book, Wet Flies, the second edition. And, of course, you want to get the second edition. Dave did mention earlier that when he was out poking around the Internet and stuff that on some sites they were still showing the first edition. But, Dave, they want the second edition from the way that you described it, right?
Yeah, I think the only way you'd get a first edition now would be as a used book. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's got
there
a
is quite
cover,
a bit of difference. Yeah. Right.
If you're a collector, you want it. You want the first edition because that's the collector's edition. But if you want to read it, which I recommend yeah. you do, you want the second edition.
Yeah. There you go. Okay.
It just came out recently, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I cleared my queue here, and Well, that's probably too tough of a question I was gonna ask. What I was going to ask, don't answer this, folks, but what I was going to ask, Dave, is what is the March Brown Spider? Is it a soft tackle? Is it a flimp? Is it both? What is it? So I want to hear your answer to that because it would have been too hard for them to answer that.
Well, so a lot of people would have got that. A March Brown Spider is Sylvester Nemus, a soft tackle. But it really gets confusing because you've got a March Brown winged wet fly and you've got a March Brown flimp. You got a lot of March Browns, but that's the only one that doesn't define what it is by its name. Maybe Sil should have named it the March Brown soft tackle. That would have been
yeah.
easy. But the March Brown spider,
yeah.
Spider is, by the way, a word for soft tackle in Britain.
Ah,
so,
okay.
So that's where
yeah,
Sylvester
and in your book you put in, this is what I'm reading, is the valuable wet fly. This valuable wet fly has a rough fur body and is a combination of the soft tackle and flimp. Well, that's where I was going to try to catch them up on that one.
Yeah,
but,
there you go. That's true.
We talked about, Dave talked about a particular insect that, well, it's a, he called it his favorite wet fly. What was his favorite wet fly? And it was because it couldn't swim very well, and so consequently made for a very good wet fly to duplicate, to imitate. And I hope that's not too broad, but let me see which one. And we got Phil, you lucky guy. He's
smart
Phil
guy.
Good at it. Yeah, Phil McCartney in California, Kentucky, and Phil wins a lot of things on the show. He's fast and pays attention. He says alderfly. That's what I was looking for. Wouldn't you say so, Dave?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I fished the Hiwassee in Tennessee, which is in Kentucky, but there's alderflies down there. I collected them on the Hiwassee, so they're not far, and he might well fish there.
Yeah,
and I'm sure there's a lot of alderflies in Kentucky as well.
Yeah, yeah. And, then we got some others, female caddis, and that's not good. Victor, you were a little slow. You had the right answer, but just a few seconds off. So, Phil, send me your address and so forth again so I can get that over to Stackpole, and then I'll send you that book out directly. So congrats again. Job well done, and thanks for playing, everybody else. It was a lot of fun. Hey, Dave, thanks so much for being on the show and taking your time out. I know you've had a busy fall here, but I really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, I had fun. It's fun to talk about fishing.
Yeah.
It makes me want to go do it. I want to go wet fly fishing now.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can't.
Exactly.
We got so much water up here in Portland right now. I could go fly fishing in the street in front of my house.
Oh, yeah. And here today it was 10 degrees where I'm at up in the Rockies. So yesterday I went for a short day of downhill skiing. Supposed to ski for like 3 hours and come back. I left at 7 in the morning. I got back at 7 at night because there was so much snow. They had avalanches, and they closed the pass behind me, so I had to detour.
Oh, no.
For hours around to go around and go over another pass, go over Loveland Pass rather than Burford Pass.
Oh, that's too bad. But
I spent
us
most of the day
pack.
In the car. So
send
anyway.
Send us your snowpack. All we're getting is rain.
Really? No, we got some good snow here now, so hopefully it'll keep up. Well, our next broadcast will be on January 6th. 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show I'm going to interview Pat Dorsey, and our topic for the show will be Colorado guide flies. Pat is a professional guide in Colorado, and he's going to give you the inside scoop on what the top Colorado guides have in their fly boxes. So these are the flies that they use day in and day out to get their clients into fish. You don't want to miss this one, so join us on January 6th. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Front Range Anglers, for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.